Please. The United States versus Munoz. Mr. Richards?
Your Honor. Your Honor, my name is Stephen Richards, and I am representing the appellant in this case, Javier Munoz. Obviously, this is a situation with Mr. Munoz comes to the court with a heavy burden to bear, having entered a plea agreement and then absconded for a number of years and then been extradited back.
And I gathered from the sentencing transcript that the government has chosen not to rest on the appeal waiver that was in this plea agreement.
Correct. They have not, and I think that's quite significant in a way. Because
it isn't. I mean, it suggests that the either there is a plea agreement in place, in which case there is no need to reassess guilt, there's no need to reassess all sorts of things, or there isn't. And it seems to me that the government has chosen to say some aspects of this plea agreement shouldn't be performed, such as this recommendation for the lower guideline range, and some we won't insist on, the appeal waiver.
Correct. I think, in a way, the government wants to have its cake and eat it too. And I think
as does Mr. Munoz.
As does Mr. Munoz.
I think he wins that battle. Actually.
But if you look at the actual plea agreement, you'll see that it was not an agreement that there were portions for which specific agreements were made. And one thing it says, by the way, at the end of the agreement is, this is the whole thing.
Does the government have to put into every plea agreement and don't abscond from the United States to Mexico? I mean, it just seems absurd to think that they should have put something like that in there.
I don't think it seems absurd at all. The government did put something in like that in there. But they applied it to specific provisions of the agreement. If you look at the stipulations, 12 A, B, C, D, what they say is, as to C and D, they're saying two-level reduction and one-level reduction if as long as he continues to accept responsibility. And I assume their argument now is, he didn't perform that, but he's not accepting responsibility because he left, even though he's still pleading guilty and saving them the trouble of the trial. But as to 12A, that the base guideline would be 30, there is no such provision in there.
Was that provision binding on the district court, the base offense level?
No, it's binding on the parties. Mm-hmm. But this was argued extensively, and the defendant below said, We think the government should be held to 30 as the recommendation. And they said no. We said all bets are off. And as to that provision,
did Mr. Munoz move to withdraw the plea agreement?
No, he did not.
Or his plea of guilty, I should say. So is it your opinion that it's smooth and easy to obtain extradition from another country? I mean, you've emphasized save the government the burden of the trial, but what about the extradition?
Well, that is some trouble, and some trouble the government went to, but it's not everything. I mean, the fact is that a plea of guilty alleviates the government of enormous burden of going to trial, having a jury selected, empaneling the jury, arguing to the jury, taking the,
We understand all of that. On the other hand, the evidence is often pretty strong in these cases. He did plead guilty. He could have moved to withdraw his guilty plea if too much of the plea agreement had just fallen apart due to his own actions for moving to Mexico. I will comment, I don't know why the government's spending prosecutorial resources on Mr. Munoz if he really had established a decent life for himself with his family down in Mexico, but that's not our job. That's the government's job to decide who to prosecute.
Well, the government chose to do that and did bring him back. But our point is, having chosen to do that, having brought him back, having not moved to vacate the plea agreement themselves or said, you know, all bets are off, having chosen to consummate the plea agreement in a sentencing, the terms of the plea agreement should not be thrown out of the window entirely.
Mr. Richards, could you address our decision in Dela Cruz? The government cites that indicating that, you know, yes, you can treat flight as a breach.
Well, I would love to address that case, and I would have two responses to it. For one thing, in Dela Cruz, there's no detailed discussion of what the actual plea agreement was. So whatever it was, we don't know. That's number one. Number two, the court in Dela Cruz laid an extraordinary emphasis on the fact that Dela Cruz not only fled to Mexico, but went to Mexico and committed the same sorts of crimes. I mean, there could be no greater breach of any agreement than that. So therefore, I don't think Dela Cruz is dispositive on this issue. Obviously, when we have plea agreements...
I guess I have trouble following that reasoning, since the court's opinion seems to treat simply the departure as a breach that relieved the government of its obligation to recommend a particular sentence.
That's not what the court in Dela Cruz says. I mean, they say specifically in the passage quoted by the appellee in their brief that his flight to Mexico and the commission of the same crime, they don't say commission of crimes, was sufficient to constitute a breach. Now, obviously, since he did go to Mexico and did commit the same crimes, the issue of whether mere flight would have been a breach was not before them.
So your theory is that mere flight is not a breach unless the plea agreement specifically says so?
Correct.
Okay. In this area of law, as you know, we often rely on principles of contract law, right?
Correct.
And in contract law, where a contract is silent about a particular possibility, war, acts of God, force majeure, something that interferes with performance, courts generally try to figure out what similarly situated parties probably would have agreed to if they had thought about the specific issue, right?
Your Honor, it's outside my expertise, but I'll take
your
word for it.
That's the way contract law works. Trust me on that.
Okay.
So why, in this case, applying that reasoning, why would we expect the government to have agreed it would still be bound by the terms of the plea agreement if the defendant fled?
Well, one, because the government obviously took into account the possibility of some sort of either further crime being committed, flight or something, when it put in the business about continued acceptance of responsibility under specific provisions of the stipulation, but left it out as to 12A, number one. Number two, the agreement at the end says, this is the whole agreement. There's nothing else. I mean, don't bring anything else up. This is all we wrote, and this is what we're writing.
But there are also provisions in contract law that say if performance becomes either impossible or if the point of the contract has been defeated, then that part of the contract isn't enforceable. Sometimes it's severable, sometimes it's not. That's a different question.
Well, the point of the contract in this case was not defeated because the defendant did, in fact, plead guilty, go to sentencing, save the government the cost of a trial.
Well, actually it was. I mean...
In part.
Yeah, five years on the run and having to extradite is hard to overlook.
It's hard to overlook, but the government made an agreement, and it's our position they are bound by it, at least as to 12A, which is what the defense argued at trial. Now, by the way, you know, should we be talking about rescission or putting the parties back where they were, we will gladly withdraw our appeal in return for a remand and a stipulation at the base 30. If that's the essence of the bargain and the government is not contesting our right to appeal.
How does the actual sentence, the sentence that was actually imposed here was below the guideline range, right?
It was below the guideline range,
as
correct.
Calculated.
It was, but the court was beginning with a base of 32, so obviously its calculations began there, not with
so
a base of 30.
How does the sentence imposed compare with the guideline range that would have applied with a base offense level of 30 and no acceptance?
I don't have that offhand, but the base between 30 and 32 is on a drug offense is extremely significant. I can't remember the exact figures, but we're talking,
okay,
I think, about...
He was sentenced to 181. The guideline range was 210, right?
Correct.
So taking off a couple of levels would put you pretty close to where the sentence was, right?
It would, but we can't know that the district court or the, would have done that had the base level been 32. It would, I mean, the logical thing would be say it would be down to 160.
In this case, we've got defendants who get below guideline ranges or below guideline sentences who are complaining about them, and that's frankly pretty unusual.
Well, in this case, it's justified in our view. And I'll reserve my remaining argument for rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. Richards. Mr. Blackington?
Good morning. May it please the court, just to answer Judge Hamilton's last question, I had the guidelines book here. If a two-level...
I'm not sure why we don't have them up here anymore, but I'll take that up internally.
So. Used to have them up here.
I guess you get computers. But the sentencing guidelines, starting with a base offense level of 30 and everything else being the same, would have been 168 to 210, which would place the sentence that the court imposed essentially in the middle of that range. The other question I wanted, I think essentially the court has asked questions that are consistent with my argument, the argument that I would make. With respect to Mr. Munoz's objection about the government breaching the plea agreement by arguing for a base offense level of 32 instead of 30, as the court indicated, we look at views, we view disputes over plea agreements based upon contract law. And in contract law, we look at the reasonable expectation of the parties when the contract's silent about something.
But when you look at the language of paragraph 12, it is stronger than what you see elsewhere. It's the parties agree to the stipulations below, and then there's all the language about this binds us, but not the court. Fine, we understand that. And it's in 12A, it's about grouping, the combined base offense level is 30, you know. And so these are apparently, you know, based on agreed facts, agreed underlying facts. So I'm not sure why this is something that's so malleable. I mean, maybe you wouldn't have to have stipulated to it, but why didn't you just argue to the court that in light of the flight, an extra obstruction of justice penalty should have been imposed or something? You could have gotten to about the same place and stuck with the plea agreement.
I think it's malleable in this case because Mr. Munoz's breach of the contract and failing to appear for sentencing excused the government from performing under the contract and staying with the stipulation.
So why didn't you just – is it your view that putting separately the notion of a plea of guilty, that's one thing, and a plea agreement that accompanies the plea of guilty, which is a separate thing. Because, of course, some people make blind pleas. You don't have to have an agreement. Is it really your view that there just isn't an agreement at all and what we have is a guilty plea with an open field for sentencing, just as we would have if there had never been an agreement?
That's my not my view, Your Honor, in general. In this specific case, though, because Mr. Munoz breached the plea agreement in the first place by not showing up for sentencing, I think that excuses the government from performing under these plea agreements.
That's what I'm saying. Why not just say, look, Mr. Munoz committed such an egregious breach of the party's common understanding of what this plea agreement was based on. We just erase the plea agreement. That way we erase the appeal waiver, we erase the base offense level of 30. We still have a guilty plea. That's a separate thing. What I'm worried about is this picking and choosing among paragraphs of the plea agreement. This one's on, this one's off, this one's off, this one's on. That seems...
Your Honor, I didn't pick and choose anything here. I think it is my position that once he breached it, and there wasn't a single provision of this plea agreement that I went before the court and say, Judge, we think these provisions apply and bind the court. And in fact, as the court noted, I didn't rely on an appellate waiver in this case,
right,
because I believe the appellate waiver, if my recollection's correct, was consistent on it with me recommending a sentence at the minimum of the guideline range, and think because I think he breached the contract, and I didn't feel compelled to perform at that point, I didn't enforce the appellate waiver. So I don't think this is a situation. If we were picking and choosing parts of the contract like the court's suggesting, you better believe I'd be pushing the appellate waiver at this point, and I'm not.
Mr. Blackington, I have to just ask, in a number of years on the Southern District of Indiana, I don't remember an alien drug defendant on pretrial release.
Your Honor, in this situation, first, he had a green card.
Mm-hmm.
And secondly, the defendant on the date, and this isn't on the record, if the court would excuse it, and the date of his arrest, he was actually not arrested by DEA. The agents were out looking for him. I received a call from his defense lawyer, and I agreed that because he had a green card, if he turned himself in, I'd agree to recommend pretrial release. And that's so, yeah, that's certainly correct.
An unusual situation. Thank you.
So, with that in mind, I don't have any other arguments I wish to make that haven't been raised by the court. If the court has any questions, I'm happy to field them. If not,
all right. Apparently not. Thank you, Mr. Blackington. Mr. Richards.
Your Honor, I will follow suit. I have nothing in rebuttal to say to what was said before, but again, I want to entertain further questions if the court wishes.
Apparently not. We thank you for your presentation and for Mr. Blackington.
Thank you.
Case is taken.